Welcome to the Matthew Moran Podcast. This week is a special one for me as it's the 50th podcast since I began back in 2016. And as you know, it's not my full-time thing, but I'm so proud to have kept it going over the years. And I've been so fortunate to have had conversations with so many inspirational photographers, filmmakers, designers, editors, thought leaders. And I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you to the Patreon supporters who have helped financially over the last couple of years, and for every one of you who have left kind comments and shared the podcast with your community. You know, a lot of hard work goes into the production of these, but I get so much out of it personally, and the warm, fuzzy feeling they touch people and have helped a few along on their journey of discovery in this industry. So it's a special number, and I have a special guest this week. His name is Randy Olson, a social documentary photographer who has photographed extensively for National Geographic over the past 30 years. He is also the founder of the Photo Society, which is an organization advocating for photographers' rights to the Photographers Advisory Board. And I was also lucky enough to have Randy as my tutor at the Missouri Photo Workshop back in 2023. So I was thrilled to be able to sit down and talk with him, go a little bit deeper to find out more about him and his work. So let's not waste any time and get to meet him. Here's Randy. Randy, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, for taking the time. Obviously, we met nearly 2 years ago now at the Missouri Photo Workshop, which I'm sure we'll spend some time talking about. But yeah, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Great. No complaints. Thanks.
Look, let's jump right in. I wanted to go back. I'm sure the listeners are curious. For those who know you, there'll be maybe some who don't know who you are as well. But can you just tell us from the very beginning, you know, what was your, you know, first photographic experience? You know, what motivated you to get into photography? Do you remember that first experience of picking up a camera?
Yeah, I think initially my father was a photographer. I thought that was super cool. Knew what I wanted to do even in high school, but probably when I realized it could be useful and, you know, could have a voice through it was photographing the longest walk where Native Americans went from Alcatraz to Washington, D.C. to protest inequity. And so there was this one situation where, you know, I'm a kid, I'm like 17, 18, something like that. And I've got my grandmother's AMC Gremlin and just going off to photograph this march. And I didn't check the weather, you know. And so in the middle of the night, 3, 4, 5 a.m., the writer from the student paper, you know, my age, and I are pushing this AMC Gremlin through 3 feet of snow and trying to, you know, I mean, just all of these things that I know to plan for now. I didn't plan for a single one of them, but there's a photograph of a lone Indian on a mountaintop, and it just looks harsh. And he looks, you know, I mean, one of the things that affected my generation in terms of pollution was an ad run in the States with a tear coming down the side of an Indian's face when people are throwing trash out of their cars, and it stopped people from, you know, throwing trash out of their cars. So, I don't know, just that scene just kind of hit me that you could use this thing to look into the eyes of other people and see what they're thinking and feeling and relay that to a greater audience.
And did you know at that time, and like you say, you were just a kid and, I mean, learning the hard way, but just going out and doing it, did you already have a strong sense of justice, like within yourself? And you know, did you already start to think that, you know, with these photographs?
No, no. I've had a privileged life. You know, we had one newspaper man's salary when I was growing up, and we had old cars and that kind of thing. But I mean, compared to what I've seen around the world, I had a very privileged life. So no, this is all kind of a wake up call at that age, that there were these kinds of inequities, and that you could maybe, you know, try to do something about it.
Yeah. But what I mean is, like, from the outset, you know, you pick up a camera, you know, you can go in so many different ways with photography, but your choice quite early on was to go down that route of, you know, social justice, or telling stories with people from, you know, disenfranchised backgrounds or whatever it might be. That was your drive.
Yeah, it came and went in college, but I don't think I really realized it fully in my first or even second. My first newspaper job was in West Virginia, so that was one of the craziest times in my life. And so,
why was that crazy? Was that straight after college? You got that job?
Well, I was it was straight out of college. I was running around with my young friends, and all of a sudden I'm in this newsroom of folks who have been, you know, constrained by geography, and their group think is very different than the group think that from my family, from my friends, from, you know, whatever. So I ended up getting fired from that job because I was a cocky young shit. And their groupthink was just toxic, you know? And so I had a plan to collect unemployment in Puerto Rico. So I walked into the editor's office with a tape recorder and said, "You're firing me, right?" Because I needed to get it on the record so I could collect unemployment in Puerto Rico. But that was, that plan didn't even last a week. The San Jose Mercury hired me almost immediately. So I didn't get to do that. But what West Virginia did for me is shape me to deal with cultures that were very different than my own. I mean, this was in the United States, but, you know, realize the sister plant to Bhopal was right there in Institute, West Virginia, and they weren't saying a word about it. You know, Bhopal had, you know, killed thousands of people. And for them, this is just the fatalism of being, you know, a West Virginian, you know. But it was this incredible set of opportunities that I didn't do as well as I wish I had, where it was all big coal, and you'd go through a 1 mile coal tunnel that was one coal truck wide. And if you met a coal truck 3/4 of the way through, you had to back up 3/4 of a mile. And then you get to a community, and then you go through another mile long coal tunnel. So, I mean, these folks and the folks that ran the newspaper came from these areas that were extremely constrained and just had a very different think than what I was used to, which is really helpful when you're later 30 years for National Geographic and you're in with a group of pygmies, you know, or women with lip plates, or people in the Black Sea, or, you know, just wherever it was. In hindsight, it was really good training to be there. But at the time, it was painful. I mean, I thought I was crazy. When I hit San Jose, I realized, oh, it wasn't me that was crazy. Or these are people like me, and those are people that are not like me. Not that they're crazy or I'm crazy. It's all relative, you know.
I mean, these sound like great lessons to learn. And whether, you know, what were the other main things that you were picking up at this time as a, you know, cocky little shit, as you referred to yourself at this newspaper? You know, like, technically, like, who were your mentors? You know, how were you learning on the job?
Well, you know, that's, I think, one of the main points that I want to talk about is that I've had this long career where I've had community. And people like you are struggling for that. I've had photographers around me where we had film, and so we went back to the darkroom every day. At Geographic, they wanted to keep the film in the building and not release it until 90 days after publication. So we were, you do a story, you're in there a month, you do a story and a half, maybe you're in DC for 2 months, and there are 20 photographers crawling around the building, and it created this community. And it gets to this Sam Abel line, beg your boss to hire someone better than yourself. And I was constantly with folks better than myself. And so what I'm looking at today, what you're dealing with, is in the States, we've lost 80% of local photographers. Wow. I looked it up in Italy. Italy's a little different because they keep figures differently. Mm-hmm. Italy's lost like 50% of their photographers. And so with digital, with, you know, being your own little island, people don't have what I had. That was maybe the most important thing I can think of in my career, to have all those folks. You know, I didn't mind trying underwater photography because Brian Scarry is a friend, you know, or, you know, whatever it is. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think all of this stuff's like really interesting. And, you know, I was going to talk about this later, but one of the things, you know, when reading about you, and we can talk a bit more in detail if we get around to it, you know, regarding the Photo Society. But one of the things I always lament is, you know, this, well, like you say, this lack of community. You know, there's no unionization, there's no real industry. There's a bit more in film, there are unions, there's more of an industry surrounding filmmaking, but with stills photography, certainly in the conservation world, documentary world, it's like we're all on our own. And, you know, you've got organizations like ILCP and, of course, you know, Photo Society picking up some of the slack. But one of the things I liked about reading about the Photo Society was, you know, this photographer's advisory board. So you were really looking after photographers in terms of negotiating contracts. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what motivated you to start that, and also just talk a little bit about the Photo Society itself.
Well, that is the motivation on PAB was happened to be elected by the photographers with four or five others during a time when Geographic was trying to take away our copyright. And we won that. The executives that were from film more than they were from still, that thought, you know, why should we own copyright? Because, you know, film crews don't own copyright because it's a crew production. So we won that. And I just decided that we needed a trade organization. So I started a 501c6. And then they took away the archive, the agency, the gallery. And so I started a 501c3 that's an archive for about 50 of the 200 photographers that are in the Photo Society. And this provides a little bit of community. I mean, once a year, we all get together. We have a speaking thing that fills a small auditorium. You know, I've started to write out against some of the things I see as divisive, and I can reach 5.5 million because of starting this organization. But when we're talking about lack of community and the loss of all these photographers, we're also talking in the States here about our democracy. Mm. And what I don't worry that there are going to be the Gordon Parks, the Larry Burroughs, the Elliot Erwitt, the Robert Frank, you know, I mean, those folks have to be, you know, there's a doctor who Melissa helped start his career. He just came out with a book that is like a Larry Burroughs or whatever, but he started through tragedy. You know, he's the reason there are backup cameras in all the cars, because he mistakenly backed up over his son and killed him.
Right.
And this trauma has, you know, maybe motivated him. So there are going to be the motivations. There are going to be these people that just kind of stand out. And what I'm worried about is the legions of me, you know, not the folks who have to be, but the legions of me that look at these folks with sledgehammers and are so influenced by them. And then someone like me takes their little hammer and kind of chips away at things. And so when you've got 80% more chipping away at something, especially in news deserts, it's a thing, you know? So one of the reasons I realized how problematic this is I'm trying to help a nonprofit here in the Pacific Northwest, and they're trying to keep pesticides out of the water supplies from the timber companies. And it affects 600,000 people's drinking water. So they found money for helicopters, and I'm up trying to create a kind of a library of clear cuts and landscapes and that kind of thing. And when I'm done with that, I, you know, Instagram is a deal with the devil initially, where you give them content for free and they give you an audience. Now it's much more a deal with the devil, where you give them content for free and you have to pay for an audience. So I can reach 5.5 million, but if we put a few thousand dollars into it, it gets out to folks who are not in their choir, which is what I keep talking to them about. So I looked them up in the IRS database, and they had $500,000 in the bank. So I called them and said, look, we need to spend a few thousand dollars on this. They said, no, we've got $15,000 in the bank. What I'd found is a fake nonprofit started by the timber companies to spew mis and disinformation with almost exactly their same name. That morphed into Timber Unity, which is basically the Proud Boys. I mean, they're allied with the Proud Boys. And this is what, when you don't have these legions of me.
Can you expand a bit on that, what you mean by legions of you?
Well, I mean, 80% more of me out there, you know, hitting things in their community. So with these news deserts, without representation, and these fake nonprofits, these extractive industries can just do the tobacco playbook all day long. You know, the tobacco playbook is having a business plan where you know you're going to kill people, but if you make money at the end of the day, you go ahead with that business plan. So news deserts, the lack of the legions of me, writers and all that, contribute to this thing where people are getting killed.
Yeah.
You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it paints a pretty bleak picture. And of course, I know that. I remember we talked about.
Yeah, I can take any dinner party down. Just like that.
But, you know, that's it. I just read
too much of the shit that goes on.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, and of course, these things haven't happened overnight. Since the digital revolution, since the social media revolution, obviously local newspapers, we used to get one. I mean, I've been living in this place where I'm talking to you from now for 13 years. And the first few years, we'd still get a local newspaper delivered through our front door. So of course, you know, that stopped. And just today I read that, you know, we have this right-wing party in the UK called Reform. You know, their leader is straight out of the Donald Trump playbook. And one of their councillors has just banned a local newspaper from reporting on them. You know, that's the kind of landscape that we're in, you know, with these small newspapers. So, you know, I remember you using that phrase news desert, you know, a few times when we were in Missouri 2 years ago. And so that's it, you know, like you talk about bringing the dinner party down, but at the same time, you're out there doing this stuff. You're active, you're going to volunteer at Missouri Photo Workshop for people like me who are enthusiastic. They want to improve their photography. They want to improve their storytelling. So there's still like hope in you. There's still, you still have a cause, right, to further So how do you reconcile that? And how do you get, you know, how do you not go in there and just be a curmudgeonly old fuck telling everyone, oh, what's the point?
Well, I can be that, but I'm basically an optimist. And I haven't ever had a therapy session as many times as people have told me, you know. You know, I photographed a family with AIDS. It was the first blue collar family that was ever in the news for any reason. It was at that time, it was all gay men or IV drug users in their very last moments of life. You know, those were the only photographs there. So I photographed this family for 7 years, photographed most of their deaths, had to come off geographic assignments to come back for funerals. And the AIDS task force who I was working with through, or they found the family for me, really thought I needed therapy, you know, that to get over this. But, you know, I think it's just a reality kind of thing. You know, it's just realism. You know, it's accepting so many people. Well, I mean, okay, here's the main thing that people fool themselves is that they're not animals, you know, that they have a soul. So they're going to go to heaven, but their beloved pet is not, you know. There's a whole book about this, that, you know, so we kill 3 billion animals worldwide per day. You know, and kind of the mental justification for that, I mean, so we can eat them. The justification for that is that we have a soul and they don't. We've had this really strange construct to make ourselves feel good. And groupthink is all about that. And I think traveling to all these different places with these different groupthinks helps me realize that, you know, what I'm living in is just a construct, you know. So when I'm in Pakistan and I'm reading about or a fixer is reading to me about a boy stoning his sister to death because she'd flirted one too many times with the neighbor boy on the rooftop, you know, that family has reinforced this. You know, it's an honor kill. You know, this is something that you have to do. And so I think I look at all of the realities that I go through as being just a construct of all of these folks that are just bags of particles. I get thrown into some kind of geographic constraint and they all start thinking, you know, a certain way. And I've been in so many different places. I mean, pygmies, there is no more different genetics in Homo sapiens than between pygmies and San people and all the rest of us, you know? And so that group think is very different, you know?
I want to jump back a bit because you know, obviously you've mentioned National Geographic a handful of times, and going from your work with the newspapers to, you know, was it something that you dreamt of when you were younger, like shining a more positive light on National Geographic before the 30 years and before, you know, we can talk a little bit more about National Geographic now, but going back then, I mean, it was the publication to work for. There was good budget for assignments. You know, was that something, was it a dream of yours when you were younger to shoot for them?
No, they called Melissa first, and then they called with an assignment for me. And it looking back at it, it may have been a mistake. I was doing so much grittier stuff at newspapers.
Yeah,
and that's who I am. It was tough even doing, you know, just one of the 3 or 4 social documentary projects they run a year. It was tough getting things that were not, you know, that were difficult to look at. And so I think the times that I did that, it had a larger effect because it has, and it was certainly a great experience for me personally. But I'm going back now through the work, and I'm turning a lot of the color into black and white. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's hard to explain, but it as great as an experience as it was, it may have been a misdirection because I answered the phone.
Because you answered the phone. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I heard you say in an interview that it gave you license to witness this huge range of, you know, other lives and other cultures. And what about, you know, you as the photographer, despite, you know, not, you know, editors not showing some of the more hard hitting stuff that perhaps a newspaper might show, like, what were you always trying to strive for picture-wise to tell those stories? You know, I think people would be interested in hearing about that, you know, particularly as storytelling, which I think is, you know, despite the industry being tough and being fractured, you know, you look at where young photographers, you know, even though I'm 48, I include myself in that, you know, are looking, you know, organizations like Sienna, Montfoto, Wildlife Photographer of the Year, you know, these big competitions. There has been such a big shift towards storytelling and conservation photography. And of course you come in on the story selling side, not necessarily conservation, but you know, you were the extractive industries guy for a number of years. And could you tell us about, you know, that process and how you developed your story within these assignments, and then also how you kind of how you became like to focus on that subject for so many years?
Well, like I probably told you at the Missouri workshop, I took what I did for newspapers, these shorter stories, and would then work these larger stories like a beat, especially if it was in one country, where I'd go back to the same group over and over and over again. And that would create one photograph, which was indicative of one of the bullet points, you know, of the story. So, you know, gold around the world, or maybe a better thing would be how they're pumping out the Ogallala aquifer. I found a subdivision in New Mexico right across from where Texas is, 88,000 unregulated pumps or pumping out that end of the aquifer, where they didn't have any water. And so these are folks who are legal immigrants, they have good jobs, they are banding together to have these nice homes that are now not worth anything because you can't get any water into them. And they're driving their pickup truck 30 miles to a neighbor who has water and filling them up with the guy's garden hose, you know. So that's a little story that created one photograph in that coverage about water and how important it is, and how there are six great aquifers in the world, and ours is the Ogallala, and we're pumping it out in Texas and southern Kansas at an unsustainable rate. So that's the newspaper thing there, just doing all these little stories. Yeah, so in a way, I was bringing that kind of work into geographic, but often, you know, there was a need to have light at the end of the tunnel on any story, whether there was light or not. there was, it's more of an encyclopedic, you know, it doesn't create enemies. It's more like Encyclopedia Britannica of conservation. So fitting that mold was always kind of difficult for me, but I couldn't have learned more from all the brilliant people I was surrounded by, and editors, you know, Kathy Moran is the whole way. I mean, Kathy's been in this kind of experience, and so I mean, it was great for me personally. I just think that maybe if I'd been thrown into another venue, and look, I mean, we're all, life is just a series of decisions. You know, you can make this one. Well, we have a friend who applied to the Peace Corps and to the Marines. And the Marines came through first, so he ended up being a helicopter pilot flying over the White House during 9/11. Where if he'd been in the Peace Corps, he would have had a completely different. So, you know, geographic was just a decision. You know, I wanted to do work there. It was a prestigious place, and maybe that was the best decision. You know, I don't know, but it I wonder if I had been thrown into a group that was more Mother Jones oriented than National Geographic oriented, what would happen?
Yeah. I mean, someone once said to me that regret is a pretty pointless emotion. I mean, I'm not saying that you regret it, but it's interesting, isn't it? Like you say, those paths we take. I mean, I was wondering if you have do you have a certain amount of sympathy for National Geographic? And, you know, we talked earlier about this audience going from whatever, there are different numbers. You know, I heard 15 million subscribers down to 1 million over the course of whatever, 10 years. And with news information just being so diluted, like, you know, those budgets just didn't exist. You know, when I interviewed Sarah and I asked her about that, because I'm always curious, you know, the audience I have are curious about, you know, how you make a living, how you do it. And, you know, she was like, with her Russia stories, there was not really a budget. It was just go and get the story and just kind of whatever it took. I mean, that's like a dream scenario in 2025.
Yeah, and it wasn't all velvet coffin stuff. I mean, having that kind of support did give you an incredible amount of freedom. Melissa had the first budget for her story in the Yoki Finoki. And the budgets I had that were multiple countries, you know, 20 years ago or whatever, to match those in today's dollars would be $380,000 for a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there were great experiences, you know, all sorts of great things about working there.
Yeah.
It just wasn't as hard-edged as I think my personality is.
Yeah. And, you know, what do you think an organization like National Geographic or anyone can do, like, in today's climate with telling stories, telling important stories out there that can reach voters, that can change hearts and minds, because there's just so much noise out there now. And how do you get, you know, and maybe we can move into talking a bit more about the Missouri Photo Workshop in this, because again, so many people now that I know have been on it since I've been on it. You know, I know a few people have applied. I know one young German girl, a German woman, sorry, who's going to be joining this year. She's like, she's so excited about doing it. She's a great photographer. And yeah, what, there are just so few outlets, there's so little money, but at the same time, what can editors do? What can these organizations do to keep that, what is, when clearly you regard as very important? And, you know, in your letter that you sent me to Sienna, you know, you talked about this is a kind of a main mission of yours, is to keep this long form storytelling alive. But, you know, how do we do that in the social media age?
Yeah, well, I've been thinking more and more that we have to do something performative. You know, print isn't working. Our phones are creating these microscopic attention spans. Social media with the algorithm to addict you to it is just a constant stream of screaming talking heads according to what your algorithm is. So I've been thinking more and more about how we should be doing things that are performative. You know, what Banksy and JR and, you know, those folks do. We have a friend who taught the workshop a number of years. You don't know her. She wasn't there when you were there, but Mary Beth Meehan, who has gotten, I think, Guggenheims or grants for going into towns, photograph, you know, where their racism is the issue. And so she photographs all these folks that are different nationalities and hangs them on three-story prints all over town. That particular one ended up being a story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about how she was doing that, you know. So this group of Photo Society, National Geographic photographers have a lot of cred just on their own. So if they would do something like that, if we could find money for them to do something like that. But the landscape changing so quickly over the last number of years that I'm looking for like something else, you know, that get people's attention, because people are just battered down by all of this other stuff, and their personalities are changing in terms of how receptive they are. When there was Life magazine that came out every month, that was a very different vehicle than, you know, hitting our phones every time we're in the bathroom or whatever.
Yeah, it's depressing. You know, I saw an article a couple of months ago about how one of the many problems with social media is there's no endpoint. So kind of like in this journalist, she likened it to casinos, where, you know, if you go to a casino, most of them don't have windows. So first of all, you don't have any distractions looking out a window, and you also have no light coming in, so you don't know what time of day it is. There's also no clocks in casinos, so there's no like kind of urgency around how long you're spending in there. So it's just spend. And she kind of compared that to scrolling. There's no end point. You just keep going and going and going. And then now, of course, there's all this medical research about what it's doing to our brains and attention spans. And yeah, it's pretty bleak picture.
Yeah. I mean, a story in Life magazine about like what I did with plastics for Geographic. And if it said that we had a equivalent of an entire plastic spoon of microplastics in all of our brains, I mean, that would have gotten attention, as opposed to, you know, folks that just mention it as they're screaming about other stuff, you know, here and there. It's just a different dynamic. It's hard to get your head around. I mean, I think the reason most of the folks that are in this group are in this is because they have something to say and they want to be part of the global conversation. But the global conversation is being hijacked by, you know, social media oligarchs and folks that can scream the loudest and, you know, have the most, you know, it's like an Alex Jones level of stuff going on across all areas of the, it's hard to compete with sanity and reason.
Of course.
And carefully thought out kinds of things.
No, I mean, that doesn't make any difference. And then you also just get labeled, you know, woke or liberal intelligentsia or whatever it is, because facts just are irrelevant now. Like you say, it's who shouts the loudest, who makes the most noise, or not only who shouts the loudest, but who also says the most audacious stuff as well. And then we all jump on that, you know, all the mainstream media jumps on it. Oh, did you, you know, Alex Jones said this or Trump said that. And it gives them more oxygen. And this is no basis to whatsoever, but it's not going to go away. So yeah, finding other ways of not confronting it, but just getting messages out there. I think that's certainly one of the biggest challenges.
And it's easier to do in a community.
Yeah, exactly. And it comes back to that. And coming back to that, you know, I've talked about Missouri Photo Workshop a few times since I've done it. Obviously, I talked about it with Sarah on the podcast last year. But for those who don't know about it, who are listening, please go back and listen to Sarah's podcast. But it would be great to talk to you about it, because you've been a serious long-term volunteer there. And I naively, well, I just assumed, I didn't know that all of you tutors volunteered your time. I don't know why. Maybe it was naive to assume that you got paid. What photographer gets paid for work, right, these days? But no, I think it just added to the big pile of, well, just joy and exhaustion and inspiration that I felt during that week. But just, yeah, talk a little bit about that workshop, just the format briefly, and then also your involvement with it. And I know you're doing it with your wife, Melissa, for the last 3 decades, but it would be great to hear about how you found out about it and then how you got involved as a tutor as well.
Well, we taught at the University of Missouri when Melissa and I were, Melissa Farlow and I were trying to just get together, get in the same place. There were nepotism policies at newspapers then and all of that. But the reason I keep doing that, and I think it's even more important now than ever, is it's just about one thing, you know, and it's the hardest thing to do as a photographer, and that is to just make photographs of intimate moments between humans, you know, to be in their lives long enough and in the right way that they go back to their normal lives. And there is a process for that, but it takes time. And in a professional world, that means, you know, it takes money. And I've described it to you as kind of a 3-day process with anyone where you just make sure they know you're okay. The first day, you don't make many photographs. The second day, you start to train them about what it's like to be around a camera. I don't do celebrities, so these are just normal folks. And the third day, you know, my greatest strength as a photographer is the ability to bore people to death. So I start boring them to death. They go, well, this guy's not leaving. And they go into their lives and they're a real moment. And those moments at the end of all of those photographs of this family, this group, which is what we teach there, just to do that one little piece, can become one of the bullet points of a much bigger story, you know, and that family is emblematic, like the family that couldn't get water in New Mexico. You know, they're emblematic of one of the bullet points. But what I'm seeing with the financial level of things with social documentary is that there's plenty of landscape folks out there. There's plenty of astrophotographers. You know, there's still natural, your area is still more valid than social documentary, you know, natural history. But I'm not seeing social documentary photography, you know, the kind of stuff that Gene Richards Gene Smith, you know, just, I'm not seeing it. And it's because it takes a lot of time. If you're going to support it, it takes the same kind of money as wildlife photography, because you're talking about behavior, you know, so you're online for a few weeks. I'm in a home or a set of homes for a few weeks. It's the same thing. It's just behavior. And so we keep teaching it in hopes that, you know, the folks that absolutely have to do it will find their way, you know, whether it's waiting tables or whether it's this doctor I was mentioning who, you know, is just doing it on his own because he has to, and that people find, but it's not being supported. I'm not seeing it at the level that I was during, you know, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, you know, the period where all these photographers are running around with two Leicas, you know, a 21 and 35, and two Nikons hanging off their shoulders, because that way you can get 100 frames in a session. It's just not what it was. The group think is that it's not as valuable as I think it is. And yet people still love photography, and there's a lot of amateur landscape, a lot of amateur this, a lot of amateur that. And so that gets flooded in there. And then the people hanging out or hanging like Matt Black or Donna Ferrata, or, you know, but it's a lot of older folks,
yeah,
you know,
it's
not a lot.
Yeah. At the same time, you look at, you know, my peers, like, you know, Jasper Doost, Morgan Heim, Karen Eigner, all alumni of Missouri Photo Workshop, and all, you know, started as with a natural history background, but could see the importance of telling stories about people. You know, I think gone are the days, you know, there's still a place for the long lens, beautiful behavior shot, of course. But actually, I think, which is, I that's why I'm encouraged. And I'm like you, I am an optimist that the story side of things is becoming more important in that and certainly in that field. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, you look at the World Press is still like one of the most prestigious competitions in the world, but yet, what do people do in between, you know, other than correspondents that are going out, you know, at the moment, brave people in Gaza or in Ukraine, you know, what about these, you know, stories like you were doing of just regular people on farmlands or regular people doing their things in the Congo? How do, even though we do have to change and we do have to, you know, find this way of being performative, like you say, or, you know, getting attention, there still is a thirst to spend time and tell these extraordinary stories of ordinary people. So how do you think we can support that? How do you think we can find money for that?
I don't know, but to your point, you know, conflict is being supported even more so than it was before with security people and all that kind of stuff. And the folks that are victims of conflict, I mean, that's being supported as well, you know, heavily by a few outlets, but still supported. What's not being supported are the farmers that voted for Trump and are being screwed over by him, you know, and what their lives are like, having to pay the bills and, you know, whatever, or the immigrants that voted for Trump and their life in one of their family members is being deported. You know, we didn't think we were voting for that. You know? Those kinds of subtle, more subtle stories are just going away. And there's nonprofit news now, but that's generally supported in areas where people have money to support nonprofit news. And so they already have news operations. But it's these news deserts that are, our democracy is dependent on, that is, it's the biggest problem. And I don't see anyone going in and fixing that to any extent. So, you know, it's just like Geographic always wanted to have light at the end of the tunnel on every story that they did. You're asking me for light at the end of the tunnel, and I can't, you know, see it in this very specific situation. You know, there are certainly great photography being supported, but the kind that is giving us a dictator doesn't seem to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Man.
I told you, I can take down any dinner party.
I've got all these questions. Like, oh, you know, what was it like being a Nat Geo photographer? Or, yeah, talk to me about, you know, oh, your love of the camera. Now, Randy, it's great. It's so good talking to you. I did want to talk a little bit more about the Missouri Photo Workshop and, you know, your near three decades of volunteering for it. So, you know, again, it's coming back to you being the optimist. I'm honestly not looking for the light at the tunnel in with every question.
Sure, I can talk about the positive aspect. The most positive aspect is there's nothing going on in these towns, you know, so we drive there every year, and sometimes we drive right through the town. You know, we miss it. It's just an eye blink. And since there's nothing going on, it forces the people in this workshop to concentrate on what we want them to concentrate on, that moments between humans thing. That's all they got. And when you get a group of people together to do something that kind of seems impossible on your own, but when everyone is trying it, as a group, and some are succeeding and some are paying attention to those that are succeeding. It's that group think thing. You know, you can suspend disbelief long enough to realize that this is doable, but it's never easy. I mean, humans are never easy.
No.
They've always got their stuff. And so it's just so much more difficult than landscape photography.
Oh my God. Yeah. And also talking about never easy, it was funny because, you know, I didn't know when we arrived at this workshop, I didn't know that I was going to be put in your group. And I think had I known, I maybe would have been a bit more like fearful because since subsequently I heard about, you know, oh yeah, Randy's pretty hard. He's pretty hard on the students. But you know, what was good, what was so good about it was everybody, you know, before I did it, everybody said to me, like Karen and Morgan, oh, it's great. You know, it gets you out of your comfort zone. And, you know, and I was one of the older ones there, but I really felt like I was on a level playing field with everyone. And I think that was the real beauty of that workshop, was not just all the participants, but just the access to resources to be able to sit and have conversations with people like Jim Curley, you know, yourself, Brian, who runs it, and then all the workshops that are going on. It's just this incredible immersion and this team event. And of course, there's nothing better than the very end when you see all of these photos laid out in the local gymnasium or wherever it takes place, and you know, the town being invited down, and like just there's barely a dry eye in the place. You know, all of these people, like you say, nothing's going on, but suddenly all of these photographers, these budding photojournalists, have just opened up, you know, this place in a way that nobody who lives there had ever seen it in such a way. And I think that still has a power and still has a beauty.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and if you think I'm hard, I mean, I'm just there to help. That's all I'm there for. But I'm honest about what helping entails. but earlier when it was, you know, Bill Uppridge, who, you know, photographed assassination of Robert Kennedy, Howard Chapnick, who started Black Star, Bill Garrett, who was one of the best editors of Geographic, Bob Gilka, you know, when it was that crowd, they looked at it, Clarkson. I mean, they looked at it as a boot camp.
Yeah.
And you came in and you were a miserable grunt and somehow miraculously through the brilliance of their stewardship at the end of 1 week, you were the best ever. You know, it was just this false construct. So what we do now is just, look, this is where you need to get. It doesn't matter if you get there, as long as you notice how other people are getting there. You know, your photographs are maybe the least important thing, but pay attention to what everyone else is doing and let us kind of work on where you are and just kind of bringing you up a level. We're just there to help. It's not, but it's a difficult thing to do. So helping people do something that's difficult means also being honest about, you know, kind of where they are as they're doing it, you know, and a whole range of folks. And the nice thing about the folks we're getting now, it's people who really want to do it.
Yeah.
Who are there? Nickel, you know, there are some scholarships that they offer. But what we had 20 years ago were newspapers' problem children. You know, they couldn't fix them. And so they sent us. So they sent the most ornery, you know, folk. And it really was disruptive.
Yeah.
But now it's.
No, I think it's great. I think, yeah, people obviously know a bit about it, and you know, the whole 400 frame limit. You know, I think I was fortunate. I was a photographer that grew up on film. It wasn't such a big issue for me, but I think for the digital crowd, that was an issue. But it was so good, you know, having that restraint forced you to think a lot more about the picture and picking those moments. And there are so many positive things that came out of that workshop for me that I still draw on. And I remember Brian saying about that, it's not about trying to get an award-winning set of pictures this week. That just won't happen. But what you'll do is you'll draw on this, you know, for the rest of your career, basically. And I can really see that happening over the last 2 years, the way I shoot, the lens choice, you know, the time I take. You know, ironically, like one of the things why I think I got into natural history, because I was never comfortable taking photographs of people. And then realizing, and you've said it a couple of times already, that, okay, so I've become this fox specialist over the last 8 years. And most of the time, what foxes are doing in the streets is really boring. They're just trotting around, sniffing. It's so rare you're going to get like explosive behavior. But then because I've spent so much time there, I've got a handful of really great moments that has, you know, whatever, given me success in competitions or, you know, stories in magazines. And I think, oh God, this is exactly the same. You know, what you're looking for are those moments of not necessarily explosive behavior, but just behavior that captures people's attention, the behavior that people can relate to. And so, yeah, obviously trying to get that in 1 week is really tough. And like I said, the kind of collegiate vibe and atmosphere of that whole week is incredible. And I don't know if you remember with my story with the donkey lady, like I'd already had two ideas rejected by you and Gabrielle. And I remember going home back to my Airbnb and like, oh, this is what everyone was talking about. You know, it's like I'd been doing nature for 20 years and now I'm just like right back at ground zero, humbled. And it was hard, but that experience was so, so good because it just meant that you had to dig that little bit deeper to find something that was going to resonate. And I learned this great lesson, how you can't photograph the past. You know, you come with a good idea. It might not make a good story that week, but yeah, I love that. That's stuck in my head ever since.
Well, you know, Kathy's been sending a lot of folks like you, Amy, Jesper, you know, because you're right. It is hard for folks doing natural history to photograph humans. They usually, it's hard for underwater guys to photograph humans on land. You know, it's just your head is in a different place. But the reason Kathy and I think part of the mission now for the Missouri Workshop is the most important thing is the human natural history interface, you know. 60% of insects are going to go extinct in what, 10 years, 3 billion animals a day worldwide killed for us to eat. You know, the warming of the planet, the, you know, everything that affects the natural world that you're interested in has a human Anthropocene component to it. And so it was unusual, but Brian Scarry and I did a story on global fisheries. I mean, his job was to show what was going on in the ocean in these fisheries. And unlike so much of photography in the ocean that is supposedly activism, you know, it's like this is disappearing, this is horrible, whatever. And then all you see are beautiful pictures of beautiful fish in a beautiful ocean. Brian had pictures of shark crucifixions in net, you know. It was exactly the right tone. And then my thing was how it affects humans. But if you can get one photographer to be able to do all of that on a mission, especially when these missions aren't as well funded as they have been. The idea of, you know, equivalent of $200,000-$300,000 for Brian, $200,000-$300,000 for me to do a story in today's dollars, that just doesn't exist. So training folks who can do both and who can do it on a shoestring and can plug away at it while they're doing corporate work or waiting tables or whatever it is that they're doing is, I think, an important part of the mission of that little workshop that nobody really knows about except people, you know, who really want to do this thing.
We're going to slowly come to an end here, but there are a few more things I just wanted to ask you briefly. You know, you talked about that sheet with you and Brian, and I was thinking about all of these assignments. So what, 30 you did? Or was it over 30 years? How many assignments did you do with National Geographic?
I did about one a year.
So around 30 over 30 years. And did you see like obviously, you know, you talked earlier about personally that was, you know, successful for you, but did you see any successes as a consequence of your images and together with the writing and the editing and those stories being put out there? Did you see any firsthand positive consequences from that?
Yeah. And it has to do with Geographic's reach. I think we slowed down a dam in the Yomo Valley when we did the one major story about how all these groups were going to be devastated by it. The IMF pulled out, the World Bank pulled out, it was only the Chinese and Ethiopia, and it slowed them down. I mean, they still did the dam. And the story, we were early on this plastic story where only researchers were talking about it. It wasn't in the zeitgeist at all, you know? And so we were ready with the story when the, you know, more plastic than fish in the ocean by 2050 phrases started coming out and were in the general press. So we were able to do the one kind of story that got to more people than anyone else. You know, it was in Nature. It was other places that didn't have the same kind of reach. So that was in the lobby of the UN. That was, you know, it just got used and used and used. The problem, I think it helped with the momentum, but then COVID hit, and you know, we haven't regained momentum as much as people piss and moan about how awful this is. It's not happening. So there were situations where, yeah, I think I was part of a global conversation.
And what about the future? Yeah, you said you're an optimist.
Yeah,
and I know I know you kind of joked about bringing the tone down, but you're an optimist who brings the tone down. But what are your hopes and wishes and dreams for you as a photographer and you as a storyteller? Do you think about next 5-10 years?
Well, you know, I think we're in a dark moment now. You know, I'm for the first time speaking out on social in a way that makes sense to me. You know, things that I've seen in other countries that were all fucked up that I'm now seeing here. You know, I run those pictures from the other countries, and if I have some from here as well, you know, I'm doing that. I mean, I see a resistance on a lot of fronts, and we've been here before with McCarthy, you know, for example. But again, you know, trying to say where the light of the tunnel is, I can't tell you. But it has generally appeared. When we did that fishery story, there wasn't, you know, these fisheries were just getting trashed. And what happened is they got trashed to a point, and then Greenpeace helped outfit some of the trawlers with long lines, and it became more effective, and we're still, you know, having fish to eat. And there's still fish in the ocean. There are self-correcting mechanisms with humans. I don't always know, I almost never know what they're going to be, but, you know, I've seen them happen often enough that I can be optimistic. What I'm not so optimistic about is just our presence on the planet. I think we're too selfish to overcome this warming thing. I think we're too selfish to stop all these extinctions. There've been extinctions before. If you want optimism, the earth is going to be just fine.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, there are various ways to have optimism that are not, still get at the reality of things.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I think there are people out, because I'm similar, I flip-flop, you know, when I read that we've burnt more fossil fuel since the 2015 Paris Agreement than before, you know, those kind of things, like, well, what does it matter about policy? And everyone's like backslapping and cheering. And of course, you just, you know, you talk about extinctions, you just have to look at history to see which, where we're headed. Yeah, you know, I look at people like Chris Packham in this country, who just, you know, just relentless campaigner, brilliant naturalist, TV presenter. And, you know, these people like that, you know, what you're doing with the Photo Society, what you're doing with Missouri Photo Workshop, just controlling what you can do within your immediate community. And I think it does come back to that, you know, the this sense of community and resistance is all you can do. Otherwise, you know, why would you bother getting out of bed in the morning?
Right. Do your little part and do it as well as you can. Absolutely.
Randy, that's a great way to end. Thank you so, so much for your time. It's really great to see you again. Actually, I don't know if you've noticed, but not in a weird way, but I see you every day when I come into my office, because I've got this, I've got the Missouri Photo Workshop.
Oh.
Just holding up a photo here for Randy to see. The team we were together in 2 years of Randy's great trick of getting everyone to go cheek to cheek makes for a good picture. So I see you every day. You're a great inspiration. And to anyone who's listening who's going to go on that workshop, wow, I envy it. I wish I could do it all over again. So thanks for that. Thanks so much for your time. And we'll get this out far and as wide as we can. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Thanks a million, Randy. So you know what to expect if you invite Randy over for dinner. But what a great insight and example of so many of the challenges we face as documentary photographers or conservation photographers. You know, we always need to find new ways of reaching people, finding access to finance and all the things that we bang on a lot about on this podcast. But yeah, I love Randy's attitude and approach and his dedication for teaching and passing on his knowledge and expertise to so many over so many years, especially through the Missouri Photo Workshop. So go and check that out. Actually, Missouri Photo Workshop 77 just completed. So there will no doubt be some amazing stories coming out of there. And don't forget to check out the links in the podcast page, on Randy's page, on my site. And a quick update from me. We had our first Highgate Cemetery workshop in September, which was a great success. November is now sold out. So we've added new dates for next year, 2026. So please visit Eventbrite and search for Highgate Cemetery if you'd like to attend. It would be great to see you there and, you know, share this incredible place that I've been spending so much time in over the last 5 years. That's it for now. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.